Welcome to the Mindspace podcast. I'm Joe Flanders. Thanks for tuning in. I'm recording this intro in the 2021 back to school season, and I feel like it's a moment of transition for many of us that's fraught with uncertainty, with anxiety, with stress. And I think we're still, many of us anyway, trying to recover from what was a pretty difficult summer. Just trying to process the arrival of the Delta variant, the unprecedented severe weather events in many places and fires, the revelation in Canada of just atrocious acts of violence committed against the Indigenous community in Canadian residential schools a few decades ago. And if all that wasn't enough, this is all sitting on top of just a massive mental health tragedy that's unfolding with the COVID-19 pandemic and the ongoing dysfunction in public institutions and public discourse. So it feels like it's never been more difficult to make sense of these public events in our lives. And so we head into the fall, challenged to find clarity, equanimity, a sense of peace or purpose, and perhaps to be in wise relation to all of this. And so in that context, I feel very fortunate to share an interview that I did with someone whose ideas are both ambitious and deep enough to meet this challenge of meaning making. My guest is Jamie Wheel. Jamie is the author of Recapture the Rapture, Rethinking God, Sex, and Death in a World That's Lost Its Mind, and the Pulitzer nominated global bestseller Stealing Fire: How Silicon Valley Navy SEALs and Maverick Scientists Are Revolutionizing the Way We Live and Work. He's the founder of the Flow Genome Project, an international organization dedicated to the research and training of human performance. His work and ideas have been covered in the New York Times, Financial Times, Wired, Entrepreneur, Harvard Business Review, Forbes Inc., TED, etc. Our interview covered the breakdown of traditional ways of making meaning that we are currently facing, the social, political, psychological, and environmental consequences of this breakdown, Jamie's design principles for a new meaning-making operating system, the most reliable and accessible sources of healing, inspiration, and connection, and how we could begin to implement this approach to building sustainable communities. In addition to all this, I find Jamie to be a very entertaining and compelling speaker, and so it was really fun to chat with him in this interview, and I hope you find it as interesting as I did. So without any further delay, here is my conversation with Jamie Wheel. All right, Jamie Wheel, welcome to the Mindspace podcast.
Yeah, good to be here, man.
How's the day?
I mobilized today. I actually got up and I actually moved my body again for the first time in a couple of weeks. At first I thought I just needed a down, like a deep pressure. And then I was like, I think I'm becoming a couch potato. So I got moving again. I felt good.
Was this a vacation or just resting or recuperating from something?
It was coming off a big push. I'm sure we've all lost it in the quarantine fog of when was the last time we were rested and ready and locked and loaded for life. But we had just done a big gathering in the mountains of Colorado and then had done some travel and had obviously just coming off a book launch and all that kind of stuff. So I was kind of giving myself benefit of the doubt that some part of my system needed it. But then I was like, okay, that's probably enough. Now this is becoming a new habit. So it's like,
cool. Glad to have you on the upswing. All right. So I'm super excited about this conversation. Read both your books and I'm just super pumped to kind of dig into some of the stuff. Some of the listeners will not have read Recapture the Rapture. And I do want to set up the framework for the rest of the conversation by putting in some of the foundational pieces. So let's start with, and I've heard you do this spiel 100 times, so keep it as short or, budget as much energy for this as you have for it right now. Let's start with sort of the premise for Recapture the Rapture and what I understand you're calling sort of crisis in meaning, that a lot of us are feeling a little kind of disoriented or we're suffering because the processes or the infrastructures that we use to sort of make meaning out of our complex lives have really been kind of shaken and many of us are feeling a bit lost around that. So can you just tee that up for us?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and I think we're continuing to see even more and more and more of it. Like even in this latest round of like, we're supposed to have vaccines and everybody's gonna be safe and hot back summer. And then like, oh no, whoops, and breakthrough cases. But no, there's no breakthrough cases. Actually, there's a hell of a lot more than we thought there were. Now what do we do with kids? Do we send them back? Do we mask them? Don't we mask them? And like, in some respects, we've just given up. Like, I think we're literally, and I was even having this conversation with our kids over the weekend. I'm like, because our daughter goes to school in Palo Alto, super on the ball, like maximum lockdown health provisions. Son's going to school in Colorado. We're here in Austin, which is in Texas, which is like a wheels off situation. And he was talking about like, at this point, you cannot even tell whose side someone is on as to whether they're wearing a mask or not wearing a mask. Like at one point, it was a relatively clear division. It was a tribal identification. Now you have no idea. Like what even the signs and the signifiers of our public actions are and what cascades of decisions or what ideological camps or what information we're reading to be informed, we're done. It is a complete, you know, epistemological train wreck, but also a sociocultural psychological one. So always just to say that we didn't end up in this particular mess solely or exclusively because of a particular coronavirus, right? We've been on this slide for the last couple of decades and radically intensified over the last five, which has been, and maybe even more, I think you could for sure say 2008 was also like a massive disillusioning, but then throw it into the 2016 election onwards and, you know, we have what we have. But basically that, you know, people used to get their orienting assumptions on life, the universe, and everything from organized religion. That was meaning 1.0. That has been dwindling rapidly. And then for the last 400 years plus, we had this experience of kind of modern liberalism, civil rights, nation states, private property, markets, democracy, that kind of bundled gig, including academic institutions, research, science, empiricism, all of that. And that too has been kind of crumbling. And so those are the two pillars of meaning 1.0 and 2.0. The roof's been caving in as far as any shared reality we might have been experiencing. And so into that, rather than us all becoming grown up, rational, evidence-based meritocrats or something, you know, maybe like the Sam Harris's and the Christopher Hitchens might have once forecast, we're actually getting sucked to the extremes, into fundamentalism, like doubling down on belief systems and not just traditional religious fundamentalism, you know, QAnon fundamentalism, anti-vax fundamentalism, like populist fundamentalism, like take your pick. There's all sorts of different narratives, sacred and secular, old and new, that are showing up where people are just doubling down on a rigid belief system versus some form of more provisional sense making. You know, so fundamentalism on one side or nihilism, just burn it all down, blow it up. What the fuck? Who cares? Let's party or let's riot or let's something. I mean, very Fight Club-y, right? In that sort of sense. And, you know, and diseases of despair, which is obviously, you know, a lot of the world you work in, to the rises in addiction, anxiety, depression, suicides, all of the things that you would expect when people are unmoored from their surroundings. And of course, this isn't happening in a vacuum. This is happening at a time of accelerating exponential change, both better and worse, which is also really hard. Most people put all their belief systems onto one or the other. It's either like Steven Pinker and TED Talks, exponentially better, you know, Matt Ridley, throw in the kind of folks who tend to bang that drum, or the doom and gloom naysayers, Extinction Rebellion and any others pointing out the decline of civilization and or survivability. And you're like, wait, which is it? It's both. And they're both exponential. So which way this goes is going to be a crapshoot to the very last minute. And who do I look to tell me, you know, whether I should shit or go blind? Oh, they're all dead or gone or have abandoned their posts. So it's every man for himself and do your own research. You know, so that's kind of the setup, which is we're in a tight spot and someone broke our dashboard. So how do we find our own cosmic positioning system to reorient to what must be done? Because I think the worst thing we can be doing right now is fucking nothing, because we're in that agitated, irritated, bored state. Like, we need to get off that dime and be moving in whatever direction we've chosen.
Right. So you are orienting us or trying to inspire us into a new kind of operating system for making meaning. And from Meaning 1.0, you have identified three key processes or three key, say, mind states or something: inspiration, healing, and connection. And I'll let you talk about that and then continue down towards the Alchemist Cookbook.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems, you know, there's an awful lot of utopian thinking in general. I mean, if you look at anybody from whether it's true old school Alpha and Omega Judeo-Christian stuff, like there's going to be the, you know, Armageddon and the rapture or any of those kind of things, so old school stuff, all the way to techno-utopianism, like Ray Kurzweil, and we're going to upload our consciousness to computers, to blockchain and seasteaders. You know, we're going to disrupt the nation state, and we're going to create our own little communities or civilizations. And maybe they float, maybe they don't. Maybe they're in where is it? It's not Croatia. It's Estonia. One of those Eastern European bloc has some unclaimed land that is potentially going to be a libertarian crypto paradise, right? And then, or psychedelic renaissance, you know, or trans tech, you know, Neuralink and implants, like at some, like, or immersive VR, where we all, like, there's always the, yes, this is ugly, yes, this is hard, but there's some hockey stick redemption at the other end of this. And this also shows up in info marketing and self-help and new age and pop psychology, which is let's poke your pain points and you get irritated and agitated. And then we offer you, whether it's a workshop or a pill or, you know, or a meditation practice in just 7 minute abs, and then you'll be delivered. And that is such a deep trope, you know, both of Western thought, the alpha and the omega, right, the beginning and the end. But it is, you know, it shows up in communism, it shows up in social, the substrate is, it shows up across, you know, 2000 years plus of Western thought. But then it was metastasized and weaponized by marketing in the 20th century. And Tim Wu, the guy who wrote The Master Switch and tons of other stuff, he's a badass professor and thought leader. He also wrote a book called The Merchants of Attention, something along those, The Attention Merchants, I think. And it's basically outlining the genesis of 20th century marketing. Like, how did we get to Mad Men? How did we get to Don Draper and Mad Men? And the short answer is a bunch of down on their luck, literal snake oil salesmen and washed up former preachers. And so that sense of, like, you've got chronic halitosis, try Listerine. You know, you've got dandruff, try Head and Shoulders. You've got, right, you've got the thing. You've got the fall from grace. And then here's your shot at redemption in a product, a package, a pill. And that is so entrenched, right, in everything, including the full hijack of the spiritual marketplace, that we are almost all wired to believe that there is an up and out play. If only we can find it or buy it. And, you know, and many of those end up being pathological, right? Because if the ends are heaven on earth or off it, then the means are always justified. And there's all kinds of spiritual bypassing. And there's all sorts of dissociation from the here and now. And often our social and ethical responsibilities to others and ourselves and the whole thing. So for me, that was a long ass wind up to point out that the model of, hey, there's this three-legged stool or flywheel that is the human experience of inspiration, healing, and connection. And we never get out of that. We never get out of the endless cycle of getting up to the high ground, remembering what we've forgotten, being informed and inspired, if we're lucky, only to go down into the depths of our brokenness and either get crushed there by life events and tragedies and things, or use that light to mend and heal. And then we're forever doing that, mediated by our relationships, near and far. And that sense that redemption lies not in getting to the mountaintop and camping out there, because nothing lives up there. You can visit, you can put some prayer flags up there, but you need to get back down in the valleys, right? So there is no end to this. It's forever, we're forever being propelled forward from our life, the highs, lows, and together, the kind of, like, life is tragic. That's inescapable. That's Buddha's first noble truth. That's, you know, that's Nietzsche and everybody else. Like, life is tragic. Occasionally it's magic. which blows our minds and redeems our, you know, and soothes our souls and gives us a reason for being. And then that weird back and toggling back and forth between those two things, there is nothing to do but laugh, but shrug, but be on the inside of the cosmic joke. And then it's comic. And that's that kind of sharing and buffering with each other. If we couldn't look at this all and just go like Zorba the Greek, like fucking hell, the full catastrophe. You know, like yesterday at the last night's show, there we were dancing and raising the roof, and it was nothing but Quicksilver magic. And today the kids just shat their diapers, and the repairman's not coming, and the dog just ran away. And, you know, and that's it. So the tragic, the magic, and the comic. And it feels to me that if we center ourselves there in the middle of those things without obsessing or fetishizing about one or the other, one at the expense of the other, and we just say, this is it. The full catastrophe, the human experience, my job isn't to bypass it or transcend it, it's to bear witness to the whole thing. That feels to me more grounded. That feels to me more reality tested than some saccharine sweet promise of up, up and away.
Sure. Now, I think in your argument that flywheel ultimately comes from meaning 1.0 in a more sort of religious framework. And the issue there, one of the reasons why it sort of crumbled, so to speak, is that access to these things was mediated by an elite group in a position of power. And most people had to find access to that through some watered down way and had no direct relationship to this kind of like spiritual connection. And so you're introducing some design criteria for how we ought to make meaning 3.0 work. And this is pulled out of the classical liberalism model. Can you talk about open source, scalable, and anti-fragile?
Yeah. I mean, the idea there was just that sense that I think particularly in indigenous religions, but also mystery schools, let's just full hat tip. For thousands and thousands of years, for hundreds and thousands and millions of humans, there have been absolutely effective religious and psycho-spiritual practices of initiation and transcendence. They haven't always been widely distributed. It's not like every single lost person in a given society or civilization had access. Sometimes they were quite selective in how they did their thing. But there have been massively effective, both indigenous and sort of quote-unquote civilized techniques of ecstasy and initiatory mystery cults, mystery schools, right? But I would say that somewhere post, at least in the West, right, somewhere post Constantine, Augustine, like some sort of Orthodox Christianity coming online, I'm not aware of outside of like Kabbalistic traditions and some of those kind of underground movements or the Western magical tradition, but anything kind of more mainstream got pretty watered down, you know, became pretty weak sauce initiations. So that's the sense of like, hey, no matter how much we might resent or resist the Spanish Inquisition, the priests, you know, all the sort of the man, you know, keeping us from our own birthright as far as, initiation into the mysteries. There's vital glue, there's vital nutrients in what organized religion used to offer, and that's that healing, inspiration, and connection stuff. The meaning 2.0 ideas, which is all men and women are created equal and entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You could also say, and, you know, pursuit of happiness, subset, you know, initiation into the mysteries of what it means to be a human on this earth, right? And so for that to work, you know, the notion of open source means, hey, let's try and get this out of the cloisters. Let's get this out of the elect or the elite. You know, how can we offer the tools that anybody anywhere has access to? Because we subscribe to that sense of every human on this earth is a child of God and entitled to a fair shot at the good life. Right? So if it's expensive or rare or esoteric or exclusive, then what are we doing? Right, we're just perpetuating more of the inequalities that people are becoming increasingly aware of and sick of. So that's the open source piece. The scalable piece is kind of the other side of that, which is just we're in a tight fix and there's 8 billion of us. So it's not enough to have you know, hundreds or a few thousands or even tens of thousands or even millions. You know, we kind of need billions of people on something resembling the same page, that this planet matters and that clean air, clean water, and clean soil are probably human birthrights and really shouldn't go along party lines, you know, and that we're in this to win this. We're actually in this to perpetuate living on our home planet. So those are the first two. And then the anti-fragile is, oh, we are in this goofy ass paradoxical state, which I think is creating a lot of the mental disease of the coming alive and staying alive. We are sort of, on the one hand, in the, you know, early 21st century, let's say, we are sort of blessed with the perspective of gods. You know, we've got the Large Hadron Collider, and we can look back to the moment of the Big Bang, and we can map and model the Hubble telescope and, you know, live feeds from rovers on Mars, and at the same time go, oh shit, you know, more ice melted yesterday in Greenland, you know, than fills, you know, fill in the blank river or lake, and like, and what is happening? So we're sort of coming alive at the very, very same time that we realize we might be in existential crisis. And I don't know whether to be happy and elated about this infinite possibility of consciousness and humanity, or abjectly terrified as to the stakes. And wouldn't you know it, to make it even weirder, the very same super sophisticated techno-economic civilization, including carbon economy and all the things that has provided this platform for us to be watching Alan Watts remix videos on my smartphone on YouTube, filled with cobalt and lithium and random rare earth metals and beamed up to satellites, so I get this all in real time with no lag on my buffering, is also the very same civilization that might have overcooked it for all of us. And that is an insane, like literally, an insane range of awareness to have to hold the sort of the grief and the wound of the world and the Alpha and Omega. I understand the beginning of creation, and I'm getting increasingly unable to look away from the pending end. And what do we do now?
Yeah, what do we do now?
What do we do now? Like, if we're not asking that question on a more regular basis, I think we're missing the point.
I would love it if we can get really into that. What do we do now, right now, for the rest of this conversation? Again, to tee it up, and again, spend as much time on these as you want. But the first pass at the question, what do we do now, in your book has to do with a combination of biohacks, respiration, embodiment, sexuality, sacraments, substances, and music. So how are they part of the what's now?
Well, I mean, if you put them together, and there's all sorts of different combinations, right? From simple and obvious to more subtle and nuanced and complex. But the bottom line is I think you could make a case, or at least I did, that I think one of the things we need is we need to initiate ourselves and each other into death rebirth practices, and that, you know, through the wisdom traditions, again, through, like, you know, indigenous tribes with shamanic dismemberments, kind of the death, rebirth, and the reassembly of the shaman, again, unique and high tech, badass, but not widely distributed. There was a handful of shamans for any given society. Everybody else just did the hard work of staying alive. But shamanic dismemberment, the Lucinian mysteries in ancient Greece, right, where Plato says, you know, they not only teach us how to die a better death, they teach us how to live a better life. You know, die before you die, our buddy Brian Mararescu, you know, writes in his Immortality Key, like that was just pervasive through both the Hellenic and early Christian worlds. So there's always been this nod and a wink, right, of like death, rebirth is where it's at, you know, because that is how you come to your humanity fully and for the first time. Because even if you're a firstborn human, right, where you were just conceived randomly and then spat out a birth canal into the world, you're like, fuck, I didn't choose this. I didn't want this. This isn't like, at some point you get kicked out of the womb, whether it's actual birth, like Stan Grof's perinatal matrices in holotropic work, right? He documented over decades, or whether it's I was raised in a beautiful, loving family, but then I went to high school and people were shitty. Or then I got kicked out into the world and I chased all the brass rings that everybody told me I was supposed to, but I didn't get happiness. Whatever it is, we get kicked out of the womb. We go from the pre-tragic of safety and security and limitless possibilities. I can grow up to be president or marry Sleeping Beauty or Prince Charming, and I deserve it, to the tragic of, holy shit. You know, I've been knocked on my ass, setbacks, bankruptcy, illness, divorce, disease, social disruptions, historical upheavals, you name it. And now I'm in the tragic, and we're all collectively getting dragged into the tragic. I mean, the number of people whose brains broke who lived in California last year when they're like, wait, we're in a epidemic, in a super lockdown quarantine, and then our state's burning, and now we outside was safe from the virus, but now outside is deadly for the fires. And, you know, there was a story of like a San Francisco family just freaking out, getting in their car, bundling up their kids with masks on, but now they're masks from the virus and the smoke, which is it? And just driving east until they got to a rest area on the crest of the highway where suddenly they'd left the smoke behind them. And the kids are like, look, daddy, blue sky. And they're breathing again. And you're like, if that's not some apocalyptic ass shit right there, you know, I don't know what is. So there is absolutely a need for us to both do the death rebirth thing, choose. This is Ebenezer Scrooge. This is Jimmy Stewart in A Wonderful Life. This is Dorothy in A Wizard of Oz. Like that, we memorialize this moment, right? Of like, I was whisked away on the hero's journey, right? The world I had kind of contempt for, or I was not in alignment to, I now think it might be slipping through my fingers, and I cherish it in a way I never did before, never could before. And in my choosing to be twice born, in my choosing to return home, that is my transformation. And it feels like we all need to do that. We need to go from having temper tantrums that our pre-tragic world isn't going to pan out, but not get crushed or buried by the tragic phase. And the only way to do that is to have that death rebirth initiation and to come back in the post-tragic phase. And the best examples of the post-tragic are things like, you know, the usual suspects, the Gandhi, Mandelas, and the Kings, right? Mandela was in prison, you know, Robben Island for decades, came out loving his captors. Gandhi refused to march against things of British colonialism and oppression and only marched for things. MLK says it really explicitly in his I Have a Dream, you know, when we can meet physical force, when we can rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force, which was Gandhi's concept, right? What does it mean to say, yeah, I've been knocked down, but I get up again? And that isn't something that you can get from a pep talk or a post-it note, right? Because what it means is I'm twice born and I'm a dead man walking and my life is forfeit and I am lived by love. Right. And in the movies, you know, whether it's Thelma and Louise hucking it off the Grand Canyon, or it's Harry Potter, you know, and Dumbledore's army fighting the Death Eaters, or it's, you know, Frodo in Mount Doom, you know, or it's Leonidas and 300 at Thermopylae. Right. You have to have your back against the wall. It has to be for all the marbles. And you have to basically be doomed and choose to do it anyway. Anything shy of that, you're still just skimming the cream. So psychedelic experiences there's lots of ego death and physical death examples. But one of the cases I make in the book is that I think for the first time, we probably have the, you know, that death rebirth initiations aren't just metaphorical or metaphysical. We actually understand the protocols now. And the protocols are very straightforward. And you know, not every single last piece of this happens every single time, but there's a general checklist of like, boost your vagal nerve tone, increase endorphins and dopamine and oxytocin, you know, and nitric oxide, you know, engage, you know, shift brain waves out of beta and either into gamma or theta or even down into waking delta, which is highly correlated with a deep brainstem reset, almost brain dead. It's the slowest brain waves possible. So you're pretty much... What was that movie, Flatliners, right? There's always those movies about like, what happens if we die but bring ourselves back? And then is there rad shit? And then there's always something spooky and gothic because you're not supposed to do those things, right? But actually it's turning out to be true. And it's turning out to be true with radar plots of 5-MeO-DMT of like cross-hemispheric delta wave light up you know, at moments of peaking, ketamine does the same thing. Nitrous oxide does double amplitude delta waves. So does electrical, translingual electrical stimulation. I wouldn't be at all surprised if you do it with TMS and other induction methodologies. So mechanical, non-technical, you don't need to get wrapped around the morality arguments or even efficacy arguments of a given pharmacological. It's just, these are all just levers. The key thing is, can you get to brainstem global systemic reboot, which happens to have a signature of delta wave EEG, which happens to have a consistent interior subjective description of wild ass, inspirational, totally profound information that you would often shape and direct the rest of your life around. So you're like, okay. Then, you know, throw in orgasm and any of the other kind of reboots and resets. And then you're like, okay, so now we're in a place where I am facing the tragedy and the wound of the world. It's overwhelming and creating either a yearning for fundamentalism, just somebody tell me something structured to believe, or nihilism, fuck it, diseases of despair. I'm accumulating both macro PTSD, like the trauma of a life in churny times, and micro PTSD, the daily irritations and agitations of doom scrolling and not knowing whether to shoot or go blind. I can discharge all of that from my nervous system with one of these initiatory practices, and I can have an experience of the numinous, an experience of non-ordinary realms, states, archetypal domains, transcendent possibilities. And then I can come back into this little body of my life, you know, with the art, as the artist formerly known as Prince, you know, and you're like, oh shit, this is me. And I got thumbs and I got a name and I got a zip code. Oh, I'm all in. So how do we now do that together without, and to me, that's the difference between living an egoic life, still seeking pleasure and avoiding pain, which you see a fuck ton of Instagram burners and psychedelic wannabes still doing. They're like, oh, that's bright and shiny. I want to hang that ornament on my tree, versus truly surrendered, not my will, but thy will. And can I be an instrument, right, of thy peace? Can I do something to help the least of my brothers and sisters and to bear witness? And I think the best example, I mean, Leonidas is the rah-rah aggro one, right? Like, are you with me, man? Today we go down in glory. And, you know, every CrossFit yoke bro is like, yo, fuck you, right on. You know, kill the Arabs. You know, you're like, not, well, that was not quite the point. But I think the most poignant one, other than like Thelma and Louise, which I think is badass, is the Titanic, right? The string quartet on the Titanic being like, we're fucked. It's women and children first. And we're not going to debase ourselves by scrambling ahead of that ethic. Therefore, there's not enough room on those lifeboats for us. So what can we do? It's Buddhism 101. We can seek refuge in our Dharma. We're musicians. We came here to play. So let us literally go down with the ship, playing nearer, my God, to thee. And the fact that we're even having this conversation, and the fact that anytime I tell this story, it nearly chokes me up, is you're like, oh, that is the route to immortality, right? Not saving your own hide. It's, can we do what we must so that it sends shockwaves out through time and space, that a courageous, playful, loving consciousness embodied in human form was there at some point and is now eternal.
Now, you said something a minute ago that we need to do all this together, right? There's something essentially communal about this project, which I think is a good next step for us. But I want to ask you, why do we need all this hardcore tech, whether it's like, you know, natural tech in the form of magic mushrooms or something, or like freaky pain practices, or, you know, ways of breathing that like we almost, you know, suffocate ourselves to death? Like, doesn't life provide its own natural rhythm of challenge, of like difficulty, where maybe our whole ego doesn't fall apart or die, but an idea that we had to let go of, and we're just accumulating these moments of adversity and building up our sort of our intelligence and our wisdom. And why the extra layer of fancy stuff? Shouldn't this stuff just sort of come naturally through our experience? I think, sorry, I'll just add one other layer to it. Like, one of the memes I've seen going around, and I really hate to kind of like single out a generation, but it's just for the sake of an example. But like this idea that, I don't know, millennials or even my generation, I'm sort of on the older edge of that. It's like, we've had it so good, right? Just like peace in the West, economic prosperity, everything's pretty chill, and we haven't really had to deal with much in the way of like discomfort of any, you know, real sense. And it's like global pandemic. Our ancestors were sort of called to fight on the battlefields of Europe, and we're called to like sit on the couch and eat a cookie. Like, we can do this, right? We just haven't had a lot of practice at real adversity because it's so cushy, okay? But people in less cushy lives are constantly being exposed to challenges like this and have to navigate and find meaning that way. So why the extra layer?
Well, I mean, there's two riffs to go on. One is the mollycoddled nature of our recent generations. And then the other is what is the, you said sort of the extra or the fancy, right? So in some respects you can say, well, I mean, it is all just around us. And even if you wanted to be kind of an aesthete and you just be like, oh, only natural, you're like, okay, there's still plenty of natural psychedelics, medicines, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the simplest thing is that has always been the human condition, even in indigenous societies, which is how do I keep one foot? It's being in this world, but not of it.
So why do we have to do this engineering? It's the layer that I'm talking about is this engineer. Why do we have to engineer that? Shouldn't our brains, our nervous systems be doing these processes naturally?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, for sure. Like any rich culture has the descriptions and the kind of the interpretation, has the container or the vessel to hold a human experience. I mean, Jewish culture is pretty badass at this, but there's lots of others, right? With everything from here is initiation into the world to here is marriage, here's union, here's grief, here's mourning, here's the things, right? This is what's going to show up in your life, and we've got a ritual or a scripture for pretty much every occasion. Like, you're not special, cupcake, and this is not our first rodeo, right? So on the one hand, there's absolutely just being lived by life. And that's, I always kind of think of that as like, you know, that's grandma front porch rocking chair wisdom. And in general, I would say actually women have an advantage over men at a bare ass minimum because of gestation and motherhood. So for any woman and a majority end up going through that initiatory ritual. I mean, growing life inside you and delivering it and nurturing it is a radically different thing than a dude just still being a dude through his life, right? And so those kinds of openings, you know, but all war, you know, fully faced, that is facing Kali the Destroyer, right? And that can either break a man or it can make an elder. So life has it, as does art and poetry and all the things. I would say that in general, most societies have nonetheless still had periodic ritualized encounters with non-ordinary states. And that in general, the ones that do tend to have a broader range of psychological and psychosocial health and continuity. So it's that if I'm focusing purely on survival and the here and now, I can get rather tunnel visioned, and that from time to time, not every weekend, not every month, right, expanding that to include non-ordinary states, different domains of reality, all those things is generally health-giving and a positive adaptive strategy. And at the same time, in the last 400 or 500 years, the rise of meaning 2.0, the rise of rational scientific materialism and empiricism, right? I think, therefore I am, says Descartes, you know, five senses, if it's not measurable, it doesn't exist. We have shrunk our tunnel vision to the point where, and we've burdened our egos, like our rational egoic identities of who I am and who I'm supposed to be and what I want from life and how I judge whether my life right now is satisfying to me has gone off the charts. Like, we don't even know it because it's just what we've inherited. David Brooks, I think, wrote a piece in the New York Times a few years ago, just saying how even marriage, like, I mean, a marriage, how it's evolved and we keep burdening it. And you can almost use that as a really good test case of how do we burden ourselves, right? But it used to be arranged marriages, kith and kin, you know, preventing war with your neighbors. Then there was this notion, Tristan and Isolde in the Middle Ages, and the notion of romantic love, which was still just a notion. That's why it became a best-selling book, right? Right. But and, you know, more aspirational, we should marry because we care about each other. And then it was you complete me. And then it was actually you are also responsible for my full self-actualization. And if you don't help me, you're my lover, you're my best friend, you're my co-parent, you're my entrepreneur, you're even my Instagram backdrop, you're my, you're all my things. and you're supposed to be getting me to my hashtag best life. And if you don't, I'm going to be pissed and serve you divorce papers. So we've done that to ourselves. And I actually wrote a paper in grad school just making a case that what we saw with the rise of the Native American church, right, what was called at the time the peyote cult, right, in the 1870s to 90s, was a response to the desacralization of Native American lifeways. Because 300 years before that, right, you could have an adolescent go and seek their vision quest. They could go to the sacred mountains, surround themselves with stones, not eat or drink for 4 days. And as often as not, a vision of Great Spirit would come. Something would have the veils were very thin and permeable. But then you have railroads and Gatling guns and U.S. cavalry and alcoholism, removal to reservations and food stamps and coupons and demeaning and dehumanizing and desacralizing experiences of the density of the Western worldview. And now they fucking needed peyote in the teepee to take them up and out of it. So as our egoic, empirical, material world and worldview and sense of ourselves has become all the more dense, I think you could make a case that it has been increasingly helpful, if not necessary, to have bigger booster rockets to get ourselves out of the gravitational pull of those states and spaces. So on the one hand, same as it ever was, we've always had techniques of ecstasy and renewal. And on the other hand, the increasing density of our worlds have made it harder and harder to simply just find the magic in the day-to-day living. It's a little more important to kind of engineer it and maybe even focus and intensify it to get us out of the calcification that we become entombed in.
Okay, so we're social animals and we make meaning together, and whatever new operating system we're going to install has to be done through community. How do you envision rolling this out? And what exactly is your role here?
Well, I mean, I think not by appointment, more by sort of just ongoing discovery. I find myself acting as neuroanthropologist and culture architect, right? And the neuroanthropology is just the, hey, something's happening today that seems interesting, but bet this isn't the first time it's ever happened. What happens when we look back to the historical record for precedent? And then you find it all around the world and you're like, okay, super neat. There's a there, right? Let's say pain and spirituality. What's the relationship there? And I talk about that with everything from the Lakota Sundance to the rites of the priests of Odin in Norway to Spartans, all the way to contemporary BDSM and kink. And you're like, wait, there's a there, there's this thread. What is it? And then the neuro part is saying, well, now what are the biological and psychological mechanisms of action? Why did it work? You know, I even talk about circular breathing and blowing didgeridoos, but actually, and that is how Aboriginal elders got into dream time. But vibrating the sinus cavity and engaging in interrupted nasal breathing massively, 15x boosts the production of nitric oxide in your brain, which creates peak states. And that comes from Karolinska Institute in Harvard. So you're like, oh, neat. You know, something as old as the stones, and we now have new understanding. So that's the neuroanthropology. The culture architecture is, once we understand the mechanisms of action, what else can we build going forwards, knowing, like, separating mythologies from technologies. So rather than, like, let's say, like, New Age burners who go to cacao and sound bath ceremonies, and they're all wearing white linen and mala beads, and they've got eagle feathers they're probably not supposed to have, and they're just parroting. They're basically, it's just cultural appropriation of things they don't understand, and they don't even understand which bits of it work, right? And it's just, a lot of it becomes like a cargo cult, you know, like we're aping or imitating a host of behaviors because something in there we think happened, but we don't actually know what. So I would say culture architecture. And then, of course, you know, it would be a pretty sterile or unimaginative point to stop there and be like, all I do is map, you know, like Asperger boy with a train set, like all I do is map the possibilities and it's up to somebody else to actually pull the trigger. No, like, of course, because we're mapping these things, we love exploring our best efforts too, but with the understanding that our best efforts is just one effort. And as much as anything else, our attempts, like we've just done a gathering for 100 people running all of this software, you know, being like, we're going to discuss culture architecture. We're going to discuss healthy community, but we're also actually going to be practicing it as we talk about it. So we had Rising Appalachia, this the awesome, you know, folk band and duo. They were both teaching drumming and teaching Americana songs during the day, but then providing performances at night. We had a keto master. We had all sorts of things because it was like, look, these are the Lego blocks. Here's the instruction manual. Let's build something. Let's build the raddest thing we can think of. And then if you're inspired, either that's hands down the raddest thing you could think of either, or it inspires your thinking and you come up with something even better, which is even better. Because now we're generating consciousness. So we've just launched this week a interactive alternate reality game. You know, so if you were going to build Church 3.0, it wouldn't be in a building, you know, because they'd blow it down or burn it down. They'd blow it up or shut or burn it down, right? So you're like, no, like, let's just sling memes in hyperspace. It's called YAnon, as a riff on QAnon. And the intention is just to have people engage in the DIY, find and discover the tools for transformation as part of a big grand narrative and story as play, you know, because my sense is, and we've got lots of friends who are working hard on combating misinformation in the information ecology and like working with three-letter agencies and governors and policies and politicians and this and that and busting their ass to like basically come up with better Wikipedia pages, you know, and I'm 100% in support of what they're doing. But I also think it's like bringing a banana to a gunfight. You know, you're like, QAnon is working because people are aching for an orienting mythology right now, right? So we actually need to belly up at the level of mythologies and tell better stories, right? Because if you look at QAnon just as a structure, it's really weak sauce. It's unimaginative, derivative, you know, doesn't go anywhere, has been consistently wrong, you know, and people are bending over backwards to add fuel to it anyway. You know, so the things that we are doing real things in the world with people. We are sharing the source code of like, hey, this stuff at least shoots straight. So go build your own. If you don't quite know what to do with it, come play with us till you get the hang of it. And then also creative and fictive efforts in this domain. But hopefully we will in no way be the first or the last.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about what you do. This is I don't know if you still call it Flow Camp or whatever, but I'd love to hear more about that.
Omega. We called it Camp Omega this year. It has a nod to like training homegrown humans, Omegans.
Super cool. I'd love to hear more about what you're actually doing there. But one question that occurred to me is like, and I'm sure you've heard this before, how is this not another recap, like another rapture story? Mm-hmm. How is this not another hockey stick narrative shape?
Yeah. And that is the one that you sort of have to forever kind of pressure test. You know, like, wait a second, we said we weren't going to do that. And yet, right? And in fact, Chris Batch, who you and I were just talking about, who wrote Diamonds from Heaven, which I'm just in the midst of reading right now, of 70 ultra high octane LSD trips conducted in therapeutic settings over 2 decades. And then this is his book, Reporting Back. And to me, and it just came out like in 2020, to me, it's refreshingly clean. So if you go back to John Lilly's stuff, if you go back to Philip K. Dick, if you know any of those dudes who were way, way into the pudding at the time, it's kind of loopy. And there's a lot of wonkiness, Robert Anton Wilson, you know, like the 60s and 70s were the 60s and 70s. And they just were a little soft around the edges, right? And Chris's efforts, I think, are really pristine. It is just what he experienced, and he's framed and bracketed it appropriately. But one of the things that he talks about is a sense of seeing what's coming. Seeing what's coming is a profound ecological and metasystemic crisis and collapse, and that in the midst of all that pain will be birthed a new human. I mean, that's the simplest way to describe it, that all of this pain is actually intentional, that somewhere back in the day, the powers that be, including a sort of Shiva Shakti cleaving into masculine and feminine, were like, oh, we're just one. There's nothing much going on. So let's go play hide and seek, the kind of, you know, classic Hindu mythology. But that the incarnations into 3D, it is literally the pain of human suffering that is bringing us closer and closer to full awareness in embodiment. And that was the game, and we all signed up for it. So that's a really nice integration of the problem of suffering. Like, it's not a problem. It's not original sin. We actually chose this, and that the pain, you know, at least in his experiences, he reported that not a single tear or drop of blood has been wasted. The idea that all of this impossible grief and anguish, you know, child soldiers in Rwanda and starving, you know, people in Bangladesh and fires and floods and all the things are actually essential, that we're as sort of metabolizing our way to Christogenesis, what Théod de Chardin would have called the sort of collective body of Christ, right? And he then says, oh, and it doesn't sort of matter once you fully grok that we're all reincarnating souls. Now, for me, that's a couple of bridges further than I'm comfortable going in my own meaning making. Like, I can't sign off either way on reincarnation. And in fact, I made the case in the book that, like, just epigenetic expression plus some form of DNA scanning could give us the felt sense of, hey, I've got access to information that's not in this biographical lifetime. Where did it come from? It came from my past or my ancestors. What the fuck? But it could just be that. It could just be epigenetics and genetics. You know, when we're just scanning it, we've told the story or conflated it with reincarnation, when in fact it could be, there could actually be a material biomechanical mechanism for that information to pass through, right? So as I was reading it, I both felt good, you know, like, oh, this is all on purpose. This is happening for a reason. There's an explanation for the horrific shit that's coming, and a happily ever after on the other side. But to your point, is this not just another utopian kickout? And so my sense is that at least my kind of Occam's razor thing, because I've never been comfortable. And by that, I mean, and I have had personal experiences of feeling like I'm at the end of time, that is scatesthesia, and feeling like it works out. I mean, I didn't have it in the conclusion, and I went back and I put it back in the conclusion because it actually was the original inspiration for the book. And I'm like, oh, I'm being a total coward if I leave this out. So I was like, hey, there is an experience that happens often enough. It's probably worth talking about. And that experience is you get kicked to the end. You realize it all works out. We win somehow. Goodness, truth, and beauty prevail. And you get to come back and live out these middle chapters. And it's only that experience that gives you you can hold this part loosely, these actual lives of ours, because we're not so white knuckling it. Right? Because we're actually like, oh no, this works. It's a 49-51 nail biter and triple overtime. So it's the greatest story ever told. And holy shit, we got a part in it. We got an interesting part, right? And not just, oops, I died again as a starving peasant. You know, oops, cut down again in another battle. Like, we're actually on deck. We actually have a part to play and it matters. So you're like, that's fucking cool. Would I trade that? Probably not. You know, so like, maybe I did sign up for this, or even if, at least if it's mine to do, I'm in. And then some sense of, without having to buy into a metaphysical just so story. Because for me, even if personally I was persuaded by something like that, I would never say that publicly because philosophically I've boxed myself out of those claims. I said, those are problematic, right? So how would we do this? And I think one of the keys is that our current predicament, the coming alive and staying alive, the godlike awareness of alpha, big bangs and big crunches at the same time of I can't breathe, you know, and racial injustice and social injustice and economic injustices and all these things, is too much for our rational individual egos to hold. We weren't built for this shit, right? It's like Lethal Weapon 101. We weren't built for this shit. Quite literally. I mean, E.O. Wilson, right, has got that great phrase where he says, we've got Paleolithic emotions, godlike medieval institutions, and godlike technologies, right? And that is where and who we are. And I think one of the potential moves that we can make, which is a sort of a beautiful both and, is can we start expanding our consciousness and our sense of ourselves to include intergenerational awareness and continuity, right? So that I'm living three generations back and I'm living three generations forward, and I am at the center of seven generations, right? So it's, I'm doing this for my parents and my grandparents and my great-grandparents. I'm doing this for my children and my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. And that whether or not I achieve satisfaction for my time-bound needs in my lifetime is no longer the fucking point. Which, by the way, if you speak to Ashkenazi Jews, if you speak to Kurds, if you speak to Tibetans, if you speak to any diaspora peoples, right, they are all on the Moses plan, You know, like if Yahweh had said to Moses, hey, dude, you're going to wander with your people through 39.9 years, a hot ass dusty desert, but and you're not going to get to the land of milk and honey, but your children will. Are you in? Then the answer is like, fuck yes. The only answer is fuck yes. Like, sure, would I have loved to got there myself? Yes. I mean, the night before MLK dies, he eerily echoes the same thing. He says, how long? Not long. There, I may not get there with you, right? But there is that mountaintop. And so the psychedelic experiences, the non-ordinary expansion, the death rebirth initiatory experiences of being in the timeless, of seeing how this all works out, of defragging our nervous systems, of being filled with love and courage, right? Give us a chance to say yes to that. To actually and authentically sign up for that, which is, oh, we're playing the long game. And you know, interestingly, psychologists, there's some at Princeton and at UNC that have done studies on children who have intergenerational awareness, right? Versus just nuclear family living in a suburb someplace. Three or more generations of awareness of your family, less depression, higher test scores, more likely to go to college, less likely to drop out. All these positive, it's like an immune system for the suffering and tragedies of life. And interestingly, families that are like, we kick ass, we're the best, that doesn't provide as much immunity as we've had our ups and downs and we're still standing.
So when you say a new type of human is reborn out of this process,
yeah.
It's a human that has that kind of reference frame, three generations into the future, three generations into the past. And that's where we need to get to in terms of our reference for making meaning.
Yeah. I mean, look, at this point, you know, in the sort of comparative religious literature, that's Adam Kadmon, it's Anthropos, there's all sorts of kind of placeholders for an integrated kind of Vitruvian human, right? What do they look like? How do they behave? What capacities do they have online? The best analogy, so that we don't get sucked into another utopian hockey stick, right? Like if we actually say this is incremental, this is developmental, this is following historical trends and passages, but still might include some badass inflection points. Like, you know, you add one calorie of water, you know, to a pot of water, and it goes from 99 degrees to 100, and it goes from water to steam. And that, therefore, and that gives you the Industrial Revolution, right? Like that kind of a phase change based on incremental stuff. Is that possible? And my best guess, and this is half-baked, literally, like it's what I'm noodling on right now as a thought experiment, is that what would it mean for us collectively as a species to have basically a sort of stabilized uplink to the information layer, the kinds of realms of information that we typically only experience in non-ordinary states, and at least in the 20th century and 21st century have generally kept under our hats. So there's all sorts of covert psychedelic users. There's all sorts of covert people who have stumbled into it with sexuality or with meditation or with breathwork, and they generally don't share it in their professions. They're not like, hey guys, this is where that came from. They're like, I drew up these diagrams or these blueprints. Buckminster Fuller did all of his work in what he called the design realm, you know, which was that kind of platonic realm of form. So like what happens when we actually have not like both cultural frameworks to describe it, scientific plausible mechanisms of action of what is it and how does it operate, and then effective and repeatable protocols that get us into those places and spaces such that we kind of have a steady stream, not different than I'm on Wi-Fi or on 5G, or that's problematic, 4G, because that's safe, right? So what does that look like? And I think the best thought experiment I can come up with is similar to the way that Homo sapiens went from pointing and grunting to logos, to language. And once we articulated language, we went from hundreds of thousands of years of being successful hairy apes to logos. And when we were able to express logos, we were able to articulate past, present, future. We were able to articulate science, magic, religion, technology, culture. We were able to pass on wisdom. We were able to create hyper objects, signs, symbols, and signifiers. We did all kinds of shit on top of being hairy monkeys. Now, we were still hairy monkeys, right? We still had to get enough to eat and drink. We still had to avoid sharp things and predators. So all the other stuff that had been for millions of years persisted, but then we bolted on this extra software layer of language, and it transformed who we are and what we could do and what life was like for us, to the point now where just being a primal ape feels crazy, scary hypothetical, but we are all still primal apes, you know, but we've just forgotten because the dominance of language-based consciousness is so profound. So what would it look like for us to move into quantum consciousness, and not in a bullshit new agey way, right? But in a very specific, like steady uplink to non-ordinary information states, steady interconnectivity, and transtemporal awareness of ourselves as intergenerational conduits of both genetic material and purpose and relatedness. Like Thich Nhat Hanh has a beautiful thing where he says, breathe freely, breathe for your ancestors who may not have been able to breathe freely, but now they can through you this moment. You know, so like, how do we do that? And at first it would be like, oh, that's wacky, or that's dissociative, or that's, you know, that's arrogant or whatever. But like that notion of like, we have to expand our time frame because we are on the sharp end of going into the shit show. And if we don't extend our perspective of what is this for, if it's only for me in my lifetime, then you're like little Sally and Charlie Brown. Like, I just want what's coming to me. I just want my fair share, right? It's like, no, no, no. I think we're on the, like, this is a big enough cataclysm that it will be intergenerational. No question. I mean, even if you just look at like carbon loads or ocean recoveries, take the pick. Like, there's enough energy loaded into our system right now. We don't know what's coming, but I think it's clearly going to be more volatile and unstable, and particularly in the developed West, right? Than anything we've experienced in half a century. And it is almost certainly going to involve a fuck ton of grieving for what might have been, but is clearly no longer possible. And a collapse of many things that we've taken for granted. And that amount of grief is overwhelming for any single person. Mm-hmm. So, and yet we must, right? And yet we must. So the question is how? And I think that signing up is that old Pink Floyd tune, like, did they get you to trade a walk-on part in the war for a lead role in a cage, right? And the keys to our cage are the keys to the kingdom, right? Like, we can get out of our neurotic cells. So we're off the neurotic hook, but we're on the courageous cross. Like, you're like, hey, is there more to life? Yes, there is. You know, do I have to be obsessed with likes and neurotic, petty egoic? Like, no, you don't. You know, like all your wonderings can be answered. You can have your socks blown off, and at the cost of showing up on behalf of the least of your brothers and sisters, you know, for all of humanity at the end of time. You know, it's like that Ernest Shackleton ad that probably wasn't, you know, like meager pay, chances of success low, you know, glory and honor if we pull it off kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Are you down? And to me, that's a question that can only be answered from the depths of the death rebirth experience, because anything else is aspirational.
I kind of get the impression that, and I'm sorry if this is kind of like simplifying a little too much, but as our kind of nervous systems develop and we're trying to figure out how to survive and get what we need growing up and even into adulthood, there's a certain time frame to our decisions. And maybe in a secular or liberal age, it doesn't extend much past, you know, feeling good, making sure we make enough money to buy a house and have children or whatever your story is. But that's limiting and creating this catastrophic set of conditions that we're facing down the barrel. And if we're able to extend out the like temporal and spatial territory that we're making decisions on and adapting to, we actually have a shot. And it does require a sense of letting go and loss of what we thought we wanted and needed, and courage to fight the good fight to get to the point where we're living in a way that's sustainable. How is that as a different way of stating what you just said before?
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of beautiful ways to say it. I mean, it's some respects, it's sort of, you know, it's time to set aside childish things and sort of put down our nets and go and be fishers of men, right? You're like, hey, it, you know, like my preferences for seeking pleasure and avoiding pain may be superseded. I can either collapse into those and that'll be ripped out of my hands as well. right? Or I can be like, oh, that was a good run. I'm kind of glad I got as long as I did in the kiddie pool. But now it's time to jump in the deep end. And you know, it's one of those situations, and this happens in every noble combat. This is the storming of Normandy. This is, again, you know, this is Leonidas. This is any situation where you're like, oh, we're doomed. But if I play my cut, if I die well, I am creating possibility or choices or safety or hope for someone else I cherish even more than my own skin. And whether that's we're holding the front line so that our women and children can evacuate out the back of the village, whether it's we're, you know, we have to make a stand here against the Nazis or they make it to the, you know, the battle. My godfather flew hurricanes in the Battle of Britain. You're like, what the hell? You know, like that was hairball.
I know we got to wrap up here soon, but one of the things that still feels a little tricky and abstract to me is like, if I was called into the Canadian forces and I was told you've been trained to fly this plane, now you have to go fly the plane and drop the bombs or whatever, it's a pretty well-defined task. I feel like what we're being called to do is, I mean, we're being called to do everything and nothing, and it's abstract, and we'd like stop using plastic bags and get an electric car or just not drive a car at all. Or what does the courage entail for us at this juncture?
Well, I mean, the short answer is we honestly do not know and cannot know from here. And on the other hand, we did just spend a week mapping this for folks. Right. So the sort of super short bullet list and understanding that this is totally, totally incomplete and partial would be on the personal level, keep our center, keep the light of culture and consciousness and love and family and relationships alive. Like if those get snuffed out, then there's nothing worth preserving. So like adopt a spot, find the most natural spot. It could be the biggest tree in your neighborhood. It could be a pond or a lake or a river or a creek that's got concrete in it, but like find it and re-sanctify it. Like bring a trash bag to your sacred spot and just start spending time there. Just start connecting with a place near you. You know, observe a Sabbath, half a day, right? Where, half a day dedicated to connection to source and the numinous and love. And that could be any of the practices that talk about in the book or others. And then half a day giving, like the notion of tithing, time, talent, and treasure. 1/10 of a 40-hour work week is four hours. That's half a day. So like half a day a week, dedicate to your personal Sabbath, half a day a week, dedicate to service, adopt a spot. Right. And, you know, and then go ahead. I mean, this is nothing to do with the big players in the space, but like, you know, some buddies of ours are doing sustainable salmon from Bristol Bay up in Alaska. Like have, you know, like almost redo the Catholic thing of like Fridays or fish days, right? Like have sustainable meat Friday and have some grass fed meat on a Sunday dinner or lunch and go vegetarian the rest of the week. You know, get your own energy sources and power. Get a wilderness medical training of 3 days to, you know, 10 days. Like learn to be capable and competent. Check out Transition Towns. There's a global movement that of people that are looking to build celebration, dining, gardening, community. You know, transitiontowns.org is probably what it is. Check those out. Check the 2 Kilowatt Society, which shows up in Switzerland and Germany, which is people voluntarily moving to burning only 2 kilowatts of energy as a demonstration of, hey, we can massively reduce our consumption and have better qualities of life. And for comparison of the 2 kilowatts, average US citizens consume 12. So you're like, so voluntarily, not in an austere, not in a guilty, you know, joyless way, in a like, hey, we are going to, and I think 4 of the 6 best cities to live in Europe are on it. There's like 4 major Swiss ones and a couple of German ones. So you're like, this is possible. You know, and then think of your own, you know, where does your water come from? Where does your power come from? What is your medical facilities and awareness? Be a helper, not another victim, and start locally, like start with bioregional tribalism, because any other tribalism, whether it's race, class, or creed, are generally unhealthy. And so, but we live here, we give here, like that. I mean, the bumper sticker that we would redo is grieve globally, thrive locally. So that would be my super quick and dirty on things to do that are actually real world practical, bridging that with like, how do we show up as twice more humans?
Okay. Well, listen, then what about the Alchemist Cookbook and hedonic engineering?
That's your Sunday mornings, right? That's your Sabbath.
That's the Sabbath. Gotcha.
So we don't forget, right? So that we have access to that downlink of infinite information and inspiration so that we can bring it through into 3D and make this world what we know it could be.
All right, Jamie, last question for you. Speaking of the Sabbath and all this stuff, what does a typical weekend look like in your house?
I allow myself to read books. That's one thing that I tend not to get to do during the week. And then we almost always will spend time out on the lake. We live on Lake Austin here, so it's the Colorado River. And we will spend a sunset or a morning foiling or surfing. So we will go out and bump good music and celebrate life and movement and the passing of the seasons. And then the other bit, maybe special time with my lifelong partner.
Jamie, thank you so much for doing this. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, man. Absolutely. And I hope it was understandable or followable or use to your listeners too.
I thought it was awesome. We'll have to see what kind of feedback we get, but really appreciate it. I love the scope of it and how articulate you are in sort of bringing it all together for us. So thanks a lot. I'll look into revamping my schedule to include some of the stuff you recommended. A little Sabbath on the weekend sounds pretty awesome, although I don't have access to surfing or anything like that.
Thanks for listening to the Mindspace podcast. I hope it was inspiring. If you feel the world could use a little more Mindspace, please consider supporting the podcast. The best way to do that is to leave a review on the Apple Podcast app or wherever you listen, or share your favorite episode on social media. Thanks and be well.